This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away, there are a chosen few that will stand against the vampires, the demons, and the forces of darkness. These are the voyages of the crew of Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9.
And you're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9. Tonight, Sonia and I are going to be speaking about monsters. And what's your misunderstood monster, Sonia?
Myself.
Excellent. You don't have a favourite like Frankenstein or...?
Yeah, I probably do have Frankenstein as a favourite. Definitely. Frankenstein's a monster, that is.
Yes, of course, Frankenstein's a monster. Yeah. You don't want to make that mistake. So we are going to be talking about monsters. Now, monsters can come in a couple of different categories, I suppose. We've got imaginary monsters, for which there is no real evidence, or they've only ever appeared in fiction, or fiction has been written about the idea of them existing. But we also have human monsters. And by that I mean people whose behaviour is perhaps monstrous at times, or people who, excuse me, were maybe born with, I suppose you would call it perhaps a deformity, something like that, and people see them as being freakish.
Like the Elephant Man or something like that.
Like
from
the
turn of the century. Last century, that is. Actually, the 19th century. Because we've had two since then.
That's right. Mm. The most famous Elephant Man, Joseph Merrick. The British, in the turn of the century in Britain.
Okay, so what do we mean by the word monster? And by definition, what is it? Well, according to various definitive sources, and I put those in capitals, it means some of the following. Now, it's a noun to some people to begin with, so that to me is almost like saying it is a pre-existing thing. It could be a legendary animal combining features of animal and human form, or having the forms of various animals in a combination, like a centaur, a griffin, or a sphinx. And I guess most people who may be listening in already know what those combinations mean. If you're a Sagittarian, you'll know what centaur means. If you're a griffin, well, you may not be happy with the fact that you're part eagle and part, I think it's lion actually, and sphinx, of course, is part lion and man. Any creature so ugly or monstrous as to frighten people, that's another definition. Any animal or human grotesquely deviating from the normal shape, behaviour or character of normal. A person who excites horror by wickedness, cruelty. Any animal or thing huge in size, and in biology, as follows. It can mean any animal or plant of abnormal form or structure, as from marked malformations or the absence of certain parts of organs, a grossly anomalous fetus or infant, especially one that is not viable, can't have those non-viable infants, anything unnatural or monstrous. And it can also mean, there is more, it can also be an adjective. It can mean huge, enormous, monstrous, a monster of a tree. And it can also be a synonym, like fiend, a brute, demon, a devil, miscreant. And the origins may be Latin. However, between European times, 1250 and 1300, monstra or monstrum meant portent of unnatural events, monster equivalent to monere, which meant warning. So it was to warn. And there are some related words for monster. Behemoth, I love that one. Colossus, giant, Goliath, freak. Also, is it something of a natural size or shape or quality, a prodigy, an enormity, a marvel, anything or a person of unnatural or excessive ugliness, deformity, wickedness or cruelty? And there's even monster quotes from famous people. And Anger is the enemy of nonviolence, and pride is a monster that swallows it up. Mahatma Gandhi said that, which is interesting. Whoever fights monsters should see to it that in the process he does not become a monster. Friedrich Nietzsche said that, apparently. Man as an individual is a genius, but men in the mass form the headless monster, a great brutish idiot that goes where prodded. That was Charlie Chaplin. Perhaps he was talking about his classic film from the 1930s where he depicted a great monster in the film called The Great Dictator. And Bette Davis, in this business, until you're known as a monster, you're not a star. Perhaps she was talking about her own role in All About Eve.
Yes, definitely a bit of a monster in that one.
Who was the monster?
Me nightmares.
Pretty much her protege or her underling, whatever she was called. I can see every monster as it come in, says Truman Capote, apparently. And every woman is supposed to have the same set of motives or else to be a monster, said George Eliot. And we look at the translations of the word monster, so it's not lost in translation to us. Monster in Afrikaans is monster. Monster in Dutch is rotbeest. Monster in French is monstre. Monster in Italiano is mostro. Monster in Latin is monstrum. Monster in Spanish is monstruo. Probably not saying that correctly. And monster in Swedish is odjur or vidunder, which is a little bit of a departure. There you go. So we're going to be looking at monsters tonight.
We are, and we're going to talk a little bit more about it right after these messages.
Welcome back to Sci-Fi and Squeam with Sonia and Kaz, and tonight we are looking at monsters.
Yeah? That's right. We're looking at monsters in imagination and monsters in real life.
If they are in real life. So that was Tristan, and that was from a 2004 album from Patrick Wolf. He's well named, I think.
He definitely is, and I saw him earlier in the year, and he certainly plays up to
his wolfy nature
and his wolfish
nature.
Where's
he from?
He's British.
Yeah,
but England. I'm not sure exactly where. I think he might be a Londoner.
He's a Londoner.
Yeah.
From what I've gathered anyway. But we're going to look now just, intensely, I guess, and looking at the monster and where it may come from. I mean, we all think about Mary Shelley and her influence on us with Frankenstein's monster and probably other monsters from the more natural world. But where do we get that Western concept of the monster? And I saw a film at the Acme about 2 years ago called Der Golem. It was made in 1920. The full title is Der Golem wie er in die Welt kam. That's a mouthful because obviously it's German. Made in 1920 in the Expressionist cinema. And it's set in 16th century Prague, which is basically the Jewish capital of the era of that time. And a Jewish rabbi creates a giant creature from clay called the Golem. Not to be confused with anything to do with, Peter Jackson, of course. Using sorcery, this particular rabbi brings the creature to life in order to protect the Jews of Prague from persecution. And that's the movie plot to the 1920 classic, which I was lucky enough to see a couple of years back at Acme. It was silent but definitely golden. The directors of that were Carl Bosse and Paul Wegener. Now, together with Paul Wegener, Carl Bosse in 1920 directed this, his only major film in his film history, The Golem, How He Came Into the World. That's the translation, The Realization, from a screenplay by Wegener and Henrik Galan. The film's a masterpiece of German expressionist cinema. Now, we did touch on that last week with looking at James Whale and his influences making A Bride of Frankenstein. However, before that, in the early 20s, there was something called the German cinema. And it was like a towering example of creativeness and basic innovation. Now, at the conclusion of the cooperation with Galan and Wegener after making the Golem, Bosse went to back to trashy filmmaking with films called, for example, The Black Shame in 1921. He even staged a racist anti-French propaganda film, which is a real shame and a total disappointment considering, you know, the innovation that he had with the Golem. He was initially a very talented filmmaker and a director in German cinema, so it was a real pity to see him go down that path. But unfortunately, like a lot of things within German culture, there was quite a division by the early 1930s of who was on one side and who was on the other. But looking at the concept of the Golem, what is a Golem? The origins of the word see Golem from Monstropedia Online, which according to them is they are the largest encyclopedia online of monsters. They basically say that at the core, the idea of the man, the Golem, is made from clay. And yes, it is remindful of biblical stories, particularly the Old Testament and Genesis, etc. From the earth, it is a man or a rabbi who is the only person who can animate life. And he animates a robotic-like creature, which he alone can command through ritualism and devoted belief. Also, like a mechanical manual, a rabbi can bring life and have it enter a non-living creature, and it can become a servant and he the master. So much of this is very modern conceptually in regards to the idea of artificial life with humans in control, until something goes wrong, of course, and that always happens, particularly in the story of the Golem. The wise man has the best intentions, but inevitably leads to the downfall of himself and often the deaths of innocent people, always children. And centuries later, we see Mary Shelley interpret that fairly differently in the Frankenstein story. Now, Prague, which is where the Golem character actually does formulate, was, and we must remember this, in the era the story was made, was the capital of Yiddish culture and was considered a great civilization of its time. Prague was built by the advancements of the Yiddish people who inhabited this great metropolis. It was the Paris of its day, from artisans to engineering marvels and also universities and feats unseen in that part of Europe, wealth, accomplishments in medicine and philosophy. The old Prague was the centre of Eastern European world, of the Eastern European world. And also you've got to remember, Europe was not divided like it has been in recent years post-Cold War. So the Eastern and Balkan Europe today still has a stigma attached to it of backwardness and unwarranted, I say, backwardness. But back in the day of the 15th and 16th centuries, it was a cultural magnet of advancement. The 17th century is considered the golden age of Jewish Prague. The Jewish community of Prague numbered some 15,000 people, which back then was approximately the size of 30% of the entire population. It made it the largest Ashkenazi community in the world and the second largest Jewish community in Europe after, believe it or not, Greece and Thessaloniki. Now, between the years of 1597 and 1609, the great rabbi called Judah Louis ben Basil served as Prague's chief rabbi, and he's considered the greatest Jewish scholar in Prague's history. But he's also connected to this idea of the Golem, which is really interesting. And according to legend, he created the Golem out of clay and brought it to life to protect the Jews of Prague against annihilation, because at that time, up to the date of Maria Theresa of Prague, the Empress of Prague, Empress of Austria actually, she basically said that no Jews were allowed to return to the city, and so in a very interesting sort of way, that rabbi actually went about creating the Golem. And today there is a statue outside of the gates of Prague, the original gates of Prague, that symbolise the Golem. So right. Myth becomes very, I don't know what you call it.
Becomes kind of venerated in reality, especially if, you know, the Golem.
Well, they've made a statue to venerate this creature that apparently should not exist in actual fact. But according to some of the Prague historical information, he certainly did. And in Jewish folklore, a golem, seen as Yiddish, is pronounced golem, is an animated being which is crafted from inanimate material. And in modern Hebrew, the word golem means fool, silly, even stupid or clueless or dumb. It also means cocoon in the old version of Yiddish, from which the word golem derives, which means raw material. So from the raw material, one can imprint the characteristics of the person, which is interesting. And even in the book of Genesis, Gelmi, which is an origin of golem, means my unshaped form in Hebrew. So that too is really quite interesting. The earliest stories of the golem go back to the time of, again, Genesis, where Adam is described in the Talmud as created as a golem, kneaded from mud, from a shapeless hunk. There you go. All golems are created from mud. So I don't know what that might mean to people.
Well, I think, like you alluded to earlier, it's the clay. Apparently God made Adam from clay.
Mm.
So it's that idea of creating a creature and then embodying it with whatever you want it to do. Like you said, the golem is usually a slave, I think you said.
Yeah, yeah. In many tales of the golem, it's inscribed with magic or religious words that keep it animated. And apparently writing one of the names of God on his forehead or a slip of paper in the tongue apparently will activate it, which is interesting.
Yes.
You know, that's quite modern, that idea of an activation by simple words, simple commands, without actually...
Well, I think it ties back to what we talked about the other week, which was zombies.
Mm.
To animate or reanimate something in a very simple way and make it do very simple things. We're talking monsters on Sci-Fi and Scream. We've had one SMS come through, and it's from Matt in St Kilda. And I love this one. Matt has said, my favourite monster is Count Duckula, a vegetarian vampire. He is mocked due to being back from the dead with ketchup. A very camp cartoon. And yes, it was. And I can't remember if it was David Jason who did the voice of Count Duckula, or it was someone very prolific in English, on the English stage and in theatre. Hilarious. Have you ever seen that, Sonia?
Yes.
It was from the same guys.
Pretty amusing.
It was very, very funny. It was around the same time as The Trap Door when I was a kid. We used to get home from school and watch The Trap Door, and that was a great monster kind of show as well. We've just got a couple of quick messages for you, and we will be back with more Sci-Fi and Scream after this.
Monsters. What is it all about, Kaz?
That's right. The track we just heard first was Every Me and Every You by Placebo.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that from a few monstrous times in the late 90s, early 2000s?
98, I think. Mm.
Monsters. That's right. We are talking about monsters tonight on Sci-Fi and Scream. And we've just had Sonia give us a bit of background on the golem, or the golem, which is it's from basically Jewish mythology as we understand it. It's a creature that's sort of shaped from clay and then brought to life by a rabbi or a religious man. Kind of a cool clay mud zombie thing.
But it's to do good. But with it every is, but good, there is
that's
a catch.
Right. And you can always turn it around and make it a little bit devious or for your own purposes. We would love to hear your favourite monsters or a monster that you think might be a little bit misunderstood.
What's your favourite monster?
My favourite monster, thinking about it today, I really like
at least
Hyde.
I was honest.
With the golem?
No, myself as a monster.
Oh, with yourself. No, you're not a monster. That's terrible. I'm going to talk a little bit later about the story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And I really like the idea of humans having that sort of monstrous side to them. I suppose I don't like it. I don't really want to meet with it. But it's interesting. It's that kind of duality that you get with the human human way. And we've already had Matt email in and tell us Count Duckula.
Excellent, Matt.
And we just had Gracie Lou Freebush.
Good on her.
Just texted in.
Favourite monster, Edward Scissorhands.
There you go. See, he was a bit of a misunderstood.
Was he a monster or was just a guy with different abilities?
If having giant scissors for hands doesn't make you a bit freaky and monstrous, I really don't know what does. And that's the thing. Monster can be used in a pejorative sense. So when you're saying to someone you're a complete monster, or, you know, so-and-so is a complete monster. But then again, it doesn't have to be. That's just the connotation that we give it when we use it in speech. It can mean something, like we mentioned earlier, the Elephant Man, but in this case, Edward Scissorhands. And I don't think anyone would look at a character like Edward Scissorhands.
I can't wait for Tim Burton to come out here.
It's going to be very exciting.
June or July. I think it's July.
I actually think it might even be earlier than that. But he's coming out, and they've got a big exhibition, Tim Burton exhibition, and he's a director who has dealt with monsters, I suppose, or the idea of the monster his films.
Very much so.
But what he does, and it's a great thing that he manages to do, is make the human beings, or the normal people, I suppose you could call them in the film, just as monstrous as anything from...
Because usually it's the way that those human beings deal with the so-called monster. Like, how do you respond to a person that is different? So different from yourself.
I would almost...
And if you're in a group, well, you're going to pick on that person,
I would almost argue against that from the Burton point of view, because, I mean, I watched Beetlejuice again the other day, which is one of my favourite Burton films, because it's so goddamn funny, and it deals with the idea of death in such a fantastic way. And the humans in that, especially, I think it's Catherine O'Hara, is that the actress's name?
Yeah.
The stepmother, the dad, the Otho, the... interior designer, the horrible people they get up from the city, are quite monstrous in their own way. Nothing compared to the undead or the ghosts who are living in the house. So I think Burton always puts a really nice twist.
Yeah, no, good point. Good point. And Edward was created by a mad scientist played by Vincent Price, apparently, according to one of our SMSs.
Thank you, Gracie. Yeah, she's just messaged in again and let us know. Now, I forgot Vincent Price played that.
Yes.
It was probably getting on towards the end of his
reign
time with us,
terror.
I think. But yeah, very sort of very poignant, very tragic, where he's in that house.
I still haven't got over Dr. Phibes. I mean, really, anything from the Hammer House of Horror has got its, you know, mark.
It
does its mark.
It really does.
It? Good or bad, camp or not. But we'll probably look at that a bit later in the season, and our new season coming up. And the word monster derives, as I said before, from the Latin word monstrum, meaning omen, and it's from the root word monier. Sounds very French. To warn, but can also mean prodigy or miracle. And it's a peculiar European fascination as such, with trouble and horror and all things evil. I'm just putting that out there. Now, is Mary Shelley to blame, this gifted 21-year-old, when she had published Frankenstein, or Modern Prometheus, that was the original name, in 1818 at the age of 21. And that's the full title. And now, that's a blending of revolutionary classicalness with, I don't know, almost a futurist idea, concept.
Kind of futurist, almost in a medical sense, I suppose you'd call it.
Yep. Is she the culprit? Let's put her on trial. Let's have a look. The accused, full name, Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin Shelley, born 1797, died 1851. Job description, dramatist, writer, obviously, essayist, biographer, and travel writer. An all-rounder, it seems. She would fit very finely into these post-recession times. Family connections and background. Absent mother, having died when she was only 11 days old. Absent mother always is a fine indication for someone to harbour deep emotions and deep experiences of an emotional nature. I've used that three times. Her natural mother had been an early feminist, also a philosopher, called Mary Wollstonecraft. Yes. She was named after her.
She wrote a very famous treatise called The Vindication of the Rights of Woman, which is
excellent.
Still referred to this very day.
It's amazing.
A very early piece, very important piece.
Mm. Father remarried the neighbour when little Mary was only 4 years old. Education, just an awesome education, very fortunate indeed. Her dad, William Godwin, a political philosopher, and he insisted that young Mary have the best education for a girl, of that day, which included liberal politics, views and theory, and was by all accounts informal and varied. Romance, literally you could say. She began a romance at the age of 17 with one of her father's followers, a married man, 22-year-old Mr. Percy by Shelley. And they took off to Europe and came back. Pregnant she was with a baby, which was miscarried, unfortunately, but they married in 1816 after the suicide of Percy's first wife, Harriet, which was hushed up. The scene is set. 1816, we move forward. The couple spend a summer with the notorious Lord Byron, poet and dandy romantic extraordinaire, and John William Polidori and Claire Claremont, who was to become pregnant to Byron, of course, in Geneva, Switzerland. And it was there that the outcome of such a get-together resulted in the idea of Frankenstein's monster. What happened next? Well, the death of another child in Italy, the birth of the last child who survived this time, her half-sister committing suicide with laudanum at an inn. But more tragedy was to come in the shape of the death of her beloved Percy in 1822 by drowning when a sailboat sunk off the coast of Italy. She returns to Old Blighty and from there devotes herself to the surviving child, a son called Percy, after her husband. Her career as a full-time professional author began. And many illnesses followed, unfortunately, but finally, at the age of 53, it was over. The mind was willing, but the body could no more stand the pains of the past. It is believed that she had a brain tumour that finally blew out the candle to a brilliant mind and one of such enormous influence. And for all her life, she breathed and treasured the memories of her children lost to early deaths. She lost three children. Now, Frankenstein was published anonymously in 1818. And, of course, everyone thought it was done by her husband, Percy by Shelley. And he actually didn't renege on that at the time. Life after Frankenstein. Now, by the summer of 1824, Mary Shelley moved to Kentish Town in North London to be near a person called Jane Williams. And from my investigations, she may have actually been in love with Jane Williams. And Jane was later disillusioned by such gossip and preferred to say that Mary wasn't so great after all. But sad. But also, other indications of her liberal upbringing showed that in 1827, Mary Shelley was party to a scheme that enabled her friend, a woman called Isabel Robinson, and her lover called Mary Diana Dodds, to run off together and actually marry, believe it or not, in France as a man and a woman. Thanks to Mary Shelley, who obtained false passports for the couple. So this is quite interesting. And I will add as a footnote, it was on the first anniversary of her death that her surviving son, called Percy, after her husband, opened her box desk. Which is important to a writer. Inside, he found locks of her dead children's hair, a notebook she had shared with Percy by Shelley, and a copy of his poem Adonais, which people should really look up and read, and with one page of it folded round a silk parcel containing some of his ashes and some remains of his heart.
So she was into sort of putting bits and pieces together.
And she was a liberal outside. Of the good old-fashioned sense of it.
Definitely. Well, that's with that upbringing. We are talking monsters and sci-fi and Scream tonight, and we will be right back after these messages.
Welcome back to Sci-Fi and Scream. And we're talking about the monster or monsters. And I'm Sonia, and Kaz is here as well.
Sonia was just talking about, before those messages, a little bit about Mary Shelley, who was the author of Frankenstein.
Mm.
Very, very famous and probably set off the whole mad scientist crazy monster, the Igor character as well. So spawned a lot of the ideas that still run through horror and...
Yeah, they're still there, those ideas. Are they romantic ideas, I feel? Would you say they are a romanticist idea?
They're kind of a romanticist. I mean, I don't want to... I hope none of my former English teachers are listening because I don't want to... mess up
what?
Times and periods with, you know, descriptions of times.
They actually did that. Oh, my God.
Of course. You have to do that when you're doing gothic fiction. Frankenstein, it's kind of a romantic idea. Whenever I think of Frankenstein, I also think of the more modern idea, which for me, when I was a kid watching Astro Boy, the idea that you lose, or even the Pinocchio idea as well, that you try to bring back someone in your life or put together a child or a son or an heir in bits and pieces. Edward Scissorhands, as was mentioned by Gracie, who texted in, Frankenstein, Astro Boy, Pinocchio, trying to fill this void, and it doesn't matter if you sort of piece things together and give them a soul,
even if they're not. What, take the bits you like, put it together, and hopefully the mismatch will work out.
Or even the bits that are just left. Like when you mentioned Shelley, she only had bits of her husband left, but obviously they were important to her. And who knows, if she could have been given the opportunity that Dr. Frankenstein had to reanimate her husband, even if he was just bits of ash and heart, who knows?
But she wrote that when he was still alive.
I know, but the idea was there. So obviously it's after she wrote it, and then she kept bits of him. So it could
But she
really
suffered, like, obviously she suffered never knowing her mother and being brought up in a particular situation that was difficult, I would say, and then losing three children, one after the other, must have been
and her beloved
extraordinarily
husband as
well.
Awful. Exactly. And throughout this whole story, you see that the idea of the monster can also be quite a sad one.
It's personal. We all have personal monsters, don't you think?
Some people also see themselves as monsters.
Well, I do, so, you know.
There's not quite enough time to go into the psychology of that.
No.
Now, I did mention that we were going to speak a little bit about sort of human monsters, and we also mentioned earlier in the show the Elephant Man. I just want to not
John Merrick.
Talk Joseph Merrick. John Merrick's actually, it's an error in the history.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, apparently his real name was Joseph Merrick, but his doctor accidentally wrote John.
Because he couldn't be bothered?
I don't know. They found out that it's Joseph. That was his father's name as well, so he's named after that.
Cool.
I mean, human monsters, as we said, you've got, you know, serial killers, you've got cannibals, sexual predators and abusers are often labelled in the media or the press as monsters. However, it's important to understand when you're using that label on people like that, that they are exactly what I've just said they are, which is people. And that indicates that people have that monstrous side to them, whether we like to acknowledge it or not. These horrible people, and I hate to say that, but I wouldn't call someone like Joseph Fritzl anything other than horrible.
I think probably in German culture we could go a little bit further, but
you
we
possibly,
won't.
Possibly could, but we won't go down that path.
Yeah.
But these people were born and were raised by parents, possibly, or, you know, perhaps people who loved them. And yet they turned out to be something that we might call monstrous or label monstrous. Again, you've got people who might have been born with deformities or have been malformed in some way. Sometimes people who are born with those deformities or those malformed sort of parts of their bodies end up as what used to be called sideshow freaks. Or performers.
In Indian culture.
Which Indian?
Indian subcontinent? Hindu culture. They celebrate some deformities, which is interesting.
Well, I suppose if you've
got... Because they look like some of the mythological gods.
If you've got, like, excuse me, more than
because they've got 3 million of them.
Or, you know, 12 toes or something.
8 limbs.
Yes, exactly. That I'm sure that's quite auspicious. However, in cultures that don't accept that, it can be labelled as freakish or monstrous in some ways. And that's not a fair label to some people, and it's definitely debatable. It can also be taken in a comical sense. The classic TV show, which was The Munsters, kind of made light of this whole situation. And you had the Munsters, you had, you know, the father who was a bit like Frankenstein and the mum who was a bit like, I'm not quite sure who she was supposed to be, a vampire or
something.
There's
quite a division there. Definitely there are people that like the Munsters and against the Munsters, and there are people who are pro the Addams Family.
This is the thing, you're split between,
I'm
I think
more
the
of
Munsters
an Addams
was,
Family
the Munsters was earlier than Addams Family, I think. But yeah, it's Adam's Family. I mean, I'm Adam's Family because I find Gomez hilarious.
But the Munsters are fun.
The Munsters were fun. And they had a kid, you know, she was like a vampire. He was like Frankenstein, but they had a werewolf kid.
It was the 60s.
How the hell does that
work? The early 60s, wasn't it?
Yeah. So the kind of genetic engineering wasn't even around then. And the funny thing about that family is they had this kind of genetically normal member who was sort of the freak of the family.
Freak.
And I always liked that idea. I think her name was Marilyn. She was a blonde 1950s cheerleader type.
Oh, not the freak. The long-haired.
That's, I think you're thinking of Thing from Adam's Family. Oh, not Thing, sorry. Cousin It from Adam's Family.
Okay.
But in the Munsters, you had Marilyn, who was normal, but she was kind of a freak. You've got a history of these human monsters throughout literature. So one that I'll always remember is Caliban from The Tempest. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you've read that play. He has
Brilliant.
Some great lines and some really poignant parts because he's so isolated on this island and he doesn't interact with people. And when he finally does meet people.
It's the best version of Lost.
The Tempest. I haven't watched Lost enough to see whether they've come across a Caliban-like character yet, but I really hope they had another character that's been represented like that in sort of recent film was Effie Altes in 300. I'm not sure if you remember the hunchbacked character from that. And as we said, you know, the label monster is generally just applied to someone who's born with a difference that would be sort of construed as freakish.
Often it's a difference that, to my mind, is a difference that reflects whatever the culture is, you know, involved with. Like in 300, you're dealing with a Persian, is that correct? A Persian character?
The Spartans were Greek.
No. The deformed creatures were Persian.
No, the character Effie Altes is actually on the Spartan side.
Oh, okay, there you go.
I'm not sure. Have you seen the film?
Yes.
You remember he goes and he spies and then he gives the information to the Persians and they kind of accept him, which, again,
Macedonian or is he Greek?
He's Spartan.
Oh, okay.
So I'm not sure if Sparta was in the Macedonian part of Greece. I really would have to check up on that, to be honest. So this character who I suppose you've sort of pointed it there. Yeah, he's born into a culture that doesn't accept him.
Mm.
And they, in fact, kill babies that are deformed or that don't look like they're going to be strong enough or grow into strong enough warriors. So they perform a kind of early eugenics. And he crosses over to the side of the Persians, which consider those things, the deformities or the sort of freakish abnormalities, a little more like something to be celebrated.
How things change.
Yes. Well, it was the same time, so it's funny that just two clashing civilizations were a bit like that. And again, we have mentioned one of the most famous people who was, you know, a person. He was a human being, but he was often labeled a freak or a monster, and that was Joseph Merrick, who was the Elephant Man, and he lived in 19th century Britain. No one has to date actually confirmed what caused Merrick's appearance. There have been a lot of ideas, but nothing's actually been 100% confirmed. They've done some DNA tests as well on his remains and on his the descendants in his family. And apparently, you know, despite everything that happened to him, despite his tragic and short life, Merrick's doctor, Frederick Treves, commented in some of his writings that Merrick always wanted to go to a hospital for the blind where he might find a woman who would not be repelled by his appearance. Now, I find that quite sort of sad, really. It kind of brings that tragic side, and I suppose that no matter what you look like, everybody just wants to be loved.
Thank you for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.